Hello, this is Nathaniel Madman, and we're here at the University of Chicago in the Great Walker Museum, and we're going to be talking about flowers, trees, gardening, landscape design, and saving America. And I'm honored to have with me Master Forester Mark
Dunderman.
Yes. Welcome, and let me see. I attended a couple of your tree-ins.
Yeah.
And you talked about. Talk about your position.
I own a urban forestry consulting business, and that entails helping mostly government agencies, municipalities, and state and federal agencies. In this country, South America, and Europe, in tree-related policy issues. Mm-hmm. So that's it in a nutshell.
So what issues do municipalities have? Dutch elm disease, and what else?
Well, in the Chicago area or the Midwest, Dutch elm disease historically has been an issue, and it's still an ongoing issue for communities that still have large elm populations. But emerald ash borer, which has just recently kind of reared its head in the Chicago area, is kind of the next confrontation for municipal parks and forestry departments and residents to deal with.
Now, Marshall McLuhan pointed out that, and others, that the media expert Marshall McLuhan pointed out that America is the one country where numeracy and literacy were allowed to continue unabated. So New York is composed, divided up into rectangulars, mathematical rectangulars and squares.
Yes.
And another anthropologist, whose name is slips me at the moment, said that Americans fight real hard for what's in. For maintaining the borders, but whatever happens in between the borders, they're trying to let go.
Right. Yeah.
So it's there have been a lot of benefits for this symmetrical, linear model that our country has been modeled on, but there have been some deficits too.
Yeah. I mean, when you talk about like managing trees and garden space and things, you know, issues don't stop at municipal boundaries. They just and so it really calls for understanding and cooperation between not only departments within communities or the residents within a community, but crossing borders between towns to kind of address similar issues.
Also, it may look kind of Versailles and cool and very French to have all of these same trees lined up in a row, but that can be detrimental.
Yeah, it's
it helps spread disease when the roots connect with the different trees, and then the disease is transferred from one tree to another.
Yeah, I mean Dutch elm disease is always the kind of the prime example of. I'll give the Village of Oak Park as an example. 1920s and 30s probably had 17,000 out of a total of 19,000 street trees, probably had 16,000-17,000 American elms.
Mm-hmm.
And now they have about 2,400.
Yeah.
Since the early 70s, they've lost about 14,000 American elms. And you're correct. I mean, the fungus that attacks the tree is transported by an insect, but you get most of your losses from root connections between trees. So you can lose a whole block of elms, street block of elms, in one summer. And that's what really killed off the species so heavily around here. We still have a long ways to go because the historical reaction to Dutch elm disease was that municipalities, in order to get trees back into the system, they planted a lot of trees, but the focus was still very narrow. They were typically focused on only four or five species. And now we're running the two ash species, green and white ash, are now being attacked by this emerald ash borer, and so we're repeating some of the same errors. And what I try to do with my municipal clients is try to get them to think about having no more than 3% of any one species in their whole town, in streets and parks, 3 to 5%. Trees that, like native oaks, like bur oak and swamp white oak, that are long-lived, have large canopies that contribute to the community in a lot of very positive environmental ways, increasing, using their low maintenance also, planting, putting an emphasis on them so that there's, you know, 4, 5, 6% of the population is made up of oaks. Other species like Norway maple and honey locust that have issues associated with them, planting only about 2 to 3% of those species in the town. So it's, oddly enough, you can go to any suburb or even the city of Chicago here and find over 60, 70, 80 species.
Well, historically, how did America get off track and get fascinated with this Versailles model of linear linear array of gardens and trees and lawns? I mean, now the traditional English garden is kind of asymmetrical. Serpentine pond, a bridge, maybe a Chinese or Greek pavilion. In other words, that everything is kind of broken up asymmetrically, and there's variety capability. Brown and invited and encourage variety of trees and plants. And
I mean, that tradition is and it's one I advocate. And historically, I think the University of Chicago campus was, besides the buildings being very symmetrical, the landscape was very much asymmetrical design. If you see the clumps of oaks and trees in the major quads, but you know, the English or the rural traditional design was more that, you know, humans are part of the natural landscape, whereas the French designs are, you know, man is in control of, or humans are in control of the landscape. Mm-hmm. So it's very different philosophies, and there's pros and cons of both, but with French designs, you have, you know, again, very monochromatic plantings. There's a lot of costs associated with maintaining those systems.
How much do we spend? How much water is wasted trying to feed these unnatural grasses?
You probably have to.
There's millions of dollars in water wasted.
Yeah.
In parts of the country where water is short, where out in Colorado and out in the West, where they really can't afford it.
Yeah, the Colorado River. I mean, I think most people know this by now, is that the Colorado River, by the time it gets to the California, is a little more than an ephemeral creek, because so much of the river is drained off or siphoned off for very intensive irrigation systems from Colorado all the way to California. And it has a huge environmental cost for the area. I mean, maintaining large lawns, it takes, during the middle of summer, you essentially have to be irrigating the lawn, if not every day, every other day. Mm-hmm. And that's a very large volume of water, which is some people would not consider I guess it's a renewable resource, but it's, mm-hmm, at times can be a limited resource, mm-hmm, depending on the season. So
any way to make natural grasses more palatable? I'm getting you off track. Why don't you talk about this ideal vision, how things should be done, the trees, the grasses, the buildings, the design, the maintenance, the life cycle of the trees. How are they going to be disposed of?
Yeah.
How should they be marked? I'll just sit back and let you roll.
Oh, okay. No, boy. You know what? I try to get people and municipalities to think about is that, you know, that 2-inch tree that you plant today has this long-term benefit, to the community. It can also be negative, too, if you plant the tree in an inappropriate place or pick the wrong species for the wrong site. The cost of maintenance increases. But when you're talking about a tree that lasts 60, 80, 100 years, the cumulative cost per tree is substantial. Say Chicago maintains close to 500,000 street trees. The Chicago Park District has probably a quarter million park trees to maintain. And so when you're talking about those kind of scales, you know, planting a tree appropriately that minimizes maintenance over time, but also provides very strong positive contributions in cooling and water uptake for water runoff, carbon sequestering, things like that. You know, having an expanding, healthy canopy is critical. An issue that you brought, I'm glad you mentioned, is that, you know, the tree is here. There's I learned this from Dr. George Ware at the Morton Arboretum. He does a lot of research in China, is that they have three elements of why they plant a tree or the purpose of a tree. And one is aesthetics, one is environmental benefit. But at some point down the line, someone is going to have to remove and replace that tree. And so the third leg of that kind of thinking is, what are you going to do with this wood once it's once the environmental and aesthetic benefits have declined?
Buzz saws, metal tags.
Maybe. Well, I'll give an example. Is that most wood waste in the Chicago area? I'm not speaking Chicago, actually. Diverts a lot of their street trees to a secondary wood industry. But on the suburbs, it's not typical, well, it's very typical that just, you know, large trees are removed and they get chipped up. I mean, they just turn ground into chips and mulch, which is a use, but it's not necessarily the best use for some of the species that are getting removed. A good example in the city of Cincinnati, the Parks Department there actually, when they remove a substantial size ash tree or oak tree, they work with local mills to dry the wood, cut them to specifications, and then another mill builds manufactures gym flooring and school furniture, desks, chairs, things like that, that go back into the Cincinnati's public school system, that helps toward their LEED certification and things like that. So it's, Cincinnati is a good model of how a community can take a resource and actually move it, you know, once it's, again, past its environmental and aesthetic life, reusing it back into the city system without having to take it to a landfill, for example. So it's very intriguing. It's not that we grow trees in streets and parks to manufacture wood, but it is something that I think managers need to think about, that 80, 90 years from now, when a tree has to be removed, what do you do with it? Should it go to a landfill, or are there more appropriate uses, environmentally sound uses for that tree?
So you should not live your tree.
You should what?
You should not live your tree.
Well, typically, it's rare that I'm going to outlive any of the trees that I've planted, hopefully. So that's something, it's an odd part of this profession, is that it goes back to that planting that 2-inch tree. You know, I'm not going to see the benefits of it, but I hope that generations from now will see the benefit of it. Mm-hmm. So I keep that in mind. It kind of keeps me grounded with my work, I think.
Well, talk about, for those people who may have missed that 8th grade or 5th grade class, or don't remember it, talk about all the ecology of the tree and how it supports us, animals, insects, flowers, brings air into the soil. Talk about all those ecological benefits?
Yeah, it's a good question. In that, again, what we're hoping that individuals and communities think about is that we're managing and trying to protect systems now, rather than, you know, working on or pruning tree X or tree Y. The total urban forest is really made up of park trees, street trees, but also the trees on private property. You know, it's this complete canopy of trees that we all get benefits from. And the United States Forest Service has done quite a bit of research that's coming out more and more just on what those benefits are. You know, there's corridors within the city of Chicago, down Pulaski and places where there's minimal trees. And in the middle of summer, you can tell that there's no trees there because of the cooling benefits that trees provide in other neighborhoods that have a lot of trees. And when we talk about systems, you know, my background is strictly, almost exclusively on trees. This is my undergraduate degree and my graduate degree focused on trees. But I've also had to learn that plants that support forest systems, there's hundreds of native forbs that I personally don't even know the names of, that's why I have friends for. Those forbs and plants and ground covers and trees support larger systems of native birds, animals, insects, things like that. When you have big systems like, say, the Cook County or DuPage County forest systems, you can actually see the interactions of a lot of that happening. You know, it's a whole process of, you know, a tree grows from a seed and is maintained in, you know, a forest system or in someone's backyard, and over the life of that tree, can provide food to humans, but also to wildlife and insect life. And once it's in a natural forest system, once the tree dies and falls over, it goes back into the system of providing nutrients and fertilization for the next round of trees to be growing and stuff. So it's a very symbiotic relationship. A lot of the trees that we have today, there's probably transitions to different types of wildlife and habitat just based on there being a lot more ornamentals around now rather than native oaks and hickories and things like that. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, the focus on ornamentals has also increased, for example, allergy issues. Because
explain what are ornamentals?
I use in a very general definition of non-native. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a pretty general definition, but it's most of the species that you see on streets today, 80% of them are from either Asia or Europe. Mm-hmm. And there's also an emphasis of planting trees that are male. Mm-hmm. The female variety of some species, like ginkgo, have, for example, fruit that can be like offensive to people. They're very odorous and things like that. The problem with planting just male is that there's a lot more pollen. And with pollen, there's studies coming out of Minneapolis showing that in urban areas, allergies are increasing because pollen counts are going up. And that's directly related to planting, you know, male varieties of ornamental species. It's very interesting.
But ginkgo can make great soup.
What? Oh, well, that's another good point, is that I actually don't find it that offensive. So it's, but during the...
Wasn't there one place where Chinese and other Asian restaurants wanted to find out something about how many ginkgos were in a particular place?
Yeah, in work that I've done in a couple towns, Oak Park is one example. We've had Asian communities come to the forestry department looking for female ginkgos to, and my understanding it is for mostly for a specific type of soup, but it is also some medicinal purposes with it too. Actually, if you drive through Brookfield and Riverside along Harlem Avenue in September, you'll see very many families actually out picking the fruit. There's a lot of female ginkgos along Harlem Avenue in those two towns. And it's very much a family oriented activity. And there'll be dozens of kids and adults and grandparents out collecting the fruit.
So are municipalities learning, or is it a slow process?
Yeah, it's a very slow process. It's we're doing a study right now where, you know, when we're still feeling the effects of all the American elms that were planted in the 20s, because, as an example, in Oak Park, the elms were planted 20 feet apart, and that's pretty close. That's pretty tight spacing, and it didn't allow for really good crown development. And so today, when a tree gets removed, we have to make a decision on whether or not placement is appropriate, because again, in the long term, we want to be able to place a tree that is going to have mature with a full canopy, you know, that really allows the individual tree to promote its kind of identity, you know. And that may mean on streets you may be planting trees 50 feet apart, but that'll mean in 40, 50 years we'll still have complete crown closure, but the trees will be healthier, they'll last longer, they'll have lower maintenance. Those trees that are too close together get a lot of deadwood and need maintenance. And so spacing...
Well, what's crown closure?
That's where if you look straight up, you have... complete canopy of trees. So you, the most environmental benefit come from having as high a crown closure as possible, a high canopy level. So
give me the mixology. If you were a DJ of trees, what kind of mix of trees would you like for different areas? What mix of trees would you prefer for the UC campus?
Well, on the USC campus, historically, there was a lot of bur oak and swamp white oak. A lot of the older, large, mature, majestic trees on campus were those two species of oak. The campus is planting oaks, but a little bit broader variety, red oak, swamp white oak. I don't see too many bur oak, but there's a lot of... to get vertical dimension in the forest, you have oaks and hackberry and hickory and walnut, but then for vertical dimension, for the understory, there can be mid-range trees like hornbeam, hop hornbeam, serviceberry. There's certain varieties of flowering dogwood that do well here. The redbud, which the campus has a lot of, provide for this kind of nice mix of not only just trees that have high, large canopy coverage over the campus, but intermittent-sized trees that kind of just give add color and visual dimension to the campus. And kind of also soften, very much like the English garden or landscape theories, it softens the landscape. And with its irregular design.
What would you do with the grass?
Well, grass is a really tough competitor. It's actually, if you planted a tree, a 2-inch tree out in a turf area, unless you irrigate, rainfall, just regular rainfall, probably won't get through the root systems of grass down to the root system of the tree. A lot of nutrient uptake from fertilizers gets into the grass system but does not get down to the trees because the tree's roots. Just the thick root thatch of grass is an incredible competitor. And so the best thing for any tree really is to get rid of the grass. and create mulched beds of, large mulched beds of mulch in organic matter, but you can plant fibrous-rooted, very fibrous-rooted systems like the English ivy and things like that that don't have the real dense mass of roots that compete.
So the students will sit outside on ivy?
Well, no, just smaller patches of grass.
Okay.
the English tradition is very much this mix of pastoral kind of scenes and wooded areas. And so it's really kind of a balance between the two. But in order to have a healthy canopy, you really need to provide more of a organic, landscape beneath the where the trees are. So
we would have a cooler environment in the summer.
Yep.
We would have fewer allergies.
With the right species, yes. With a lot of natives, you'd have probably less allergy issues.
Mm-hmm. So. We would have some edible things.
Yep. You could produce, when I lived in Montana, I had one apricot tree, produces fruit once every 2 years, an abundance of fruit. And from that one tree that was only 12 feet tall, produced 16 pints of jam every 2 years.
And the water bill would go down?
Yes, it would, actually. Because mm-hmm. you wouldn't be watering as much turf.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Fewer people would get stung.
Well, I won't sign off on that one. It's actually possible to make just about any species out on the campus you can make syrup from. Like the linden trees make, I'm not condoning or advocating tapping every tree, but it's possible to tap the linden trees and obtain syrup, linden syrup. That's a little bit, it's not as sweet as maple syrup, but it's possible to do. So.
Mm.
I pick, I go around in my neighborhood and I pick probably 4 or 5 bushels of walnuts a year and use the walnuts for baking. So,
do we need a stimulus plan to develop a plan of sustainability, a network of interacting, when the trees die, turn them into school chairs and supplies and walnut production and apricot and soup.
Well, it's urban forestry is also called community forestry because it's about how it's different. It draws on people's very unique interests toward trees, whether it's bird watching or like we talked about earlier. Bird watching or fruit production or just that it shades the house. So the university is actually going moving in some really positive directions in that they had an inventory of all the trees done a couple of years ago, and I'm working on that data right now to make it a little bit more accessible for the grounds staff in the university here. And the inventory will hopefully be a great tool for classes and community outreach activities and planning and design elements for the future.
So if people wanted to start at the beginning, get the Peterson books, or could anything of yours that they could read?
Well, nothing of mine. All my stuff is illegible. So the Peterson guides are great. I mean, this campus has a very rich palette of trees. I mean, there's some great species on this campus and some fairly unique ones too for the Chicago area. The Civic Knowledge Project hosts one or two tree walks a year, and I encourage students and faculty and staff to come on out and get to know the campus a little bit more intimately the next time you see one of those walks advertised.
Mm-hmm. So, is there any hot issue that you want to talk about?
Plant native. Now, I mean, I'm always for promoting. What I gave a I wrote an article recently about creating a culture of trees, and it discusses
where
how.
Where can we read it?
I think it's going to be on the Civic Knowledge Project website.
Okay.
It's just a very brief piece about. I do a lot of work in South America and Europe, and you can go to any small town in any community, in most communities in Europe, and there's a very strong identity with the community, with one tree or a group of trees or individual trees throughout the town, and the people's, the residents' connection to those trees is very, very strong. I mean, it's you'd be very hard-pressed to be able to build a house or put up a structure in place of those trees in these communities. And what I would like to do is create, increase this culture of trees.
Talk about Anne Frank's tree.
That's how I was leading to that. Yeah. People may know that Anne Frank wrote about a horse chestnut tree that was in her neighbor's backyard when her family and her and she were in hiding in Amsterdam during World War II. And next week, May 13th, up in Lincolnwood, we're going to be planting a horse chestnut to commemorate Anne Frank. May 13th in 1944 was the last time that Anne Frank wrote about her particular horse chestnut tree before the family was discovered. And so this year, Lincolnwood is commemorating their Arbor Day to Anne Frank and having their Arbor Day celebration on May 13th. Oddly enough, that horse chestnut tree, it's still around in Amsterdam, and it's not very good shape, but it's estimated to be 170 years old. And we don't get that kind of longevity out of trees in urban areas in the United States. And I'm hoping that with a kind of a rejuvenated public interest in trees in the community, that we all can play a part in becoming more culturally connected with trees and extending the life and benefits trees provide for us.
Was the tree in the Wizard of Oz correct when it stood up for itself? wouldn't let it pick its fruit?
I've seen actually live real versions of that, and where trees have fallen over, where communities have marked trees for removal and they've actually fallen over onto municipal vehicles. not right when the tree was marked, but trees can't advocate for themselves, and I firmly believe that we're, you know, as stewards of the system that we live in, the community that we live in, that we're the advocates and the stewards for maintaining them. So,
well, thank you very, very much. What's your proper title? Forester?
Urban Forester.
Urban Forester Consultant.
Yes.
And Mr. Mark?
Dunteman.
Dunteman.
Yes.
And that is the Civic Knowledge Project and the Art Museum of Chicago.
Thanks, Nathaniel.
Yeah.